You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to our newest affiliate, KBCS 91.3 FM in Seattle, Washington. And it is Friday, which means, of course, it is time for our national town hall meeting, our meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. And Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. By the way, last week or the week before, you kind of wondered out loud how long we'd been doing this. And we've been doing it since the year before you ran for re-election for the House. So that would be 6 years in the Senate plus 2 years in the House plus a year, I think.
All right. 9 years. Wow.
Yeah. It's quite a while. Anyhow.
We've taken a lot of questions in 9 years.
Huh? We have. So there's a lot going on. I got your newsletter here, but I'd like to hear it from you. What's your take on the big events of the
lot,
day?
There is a lot that's going on. Congress is going to be out of session for a couple of weeks after the fiscal cliff situation. But let me go over the fiscal cliff. I don't want to go over the fiscal cliff. Let me describe right. What the fiscal cliff was about. The legislation that we passed with very strong numbers in the Senate and was passed in the House is not a good piece of legislation. I voted for it, Tom, because I thought the alternative would have been much worse. The alternative would have meant withdrawing some $4 trillion out of the economy in terms of increased taxes and cuts in programs, which, according to economists, could have left us in a severe recession mode and more unemployment. Furthermore, without that legislation, 2 million workers would not have continued receiving their unemployment checks, and that's enormously important for families who are just barely hanging on. Doctors who treat Medicare patients would have seen a 27% reduction in their reimbursement rates, and many of those doctors simply would not have been treating senior citizens on Medicare, and that would have been a disaster. And of course, taxes would have gone up, income taxes would have gone up for some 99% of Americans. Now, what will go up, and there's some confusion there, is payroll taxes. 2 years ago, Congress voted to lower payroll taxes from 6.2 to 4.2%. That is ending, and those payroll taxes will go back to what they were. And I, in fact, think that that's important because that's money going into the Social Security Trust Fund. Right. Now, the other point that I thought in terms of this debate where we succeeded was that we kept at bay. We pushed back efforts for the so-called chained CPI. Now, I know that nobody outside of the Beltway knows what the so-called chained CPI is. But when you hear Republicans and some Democrats talking about quote-unquote entitlement reform, what they are really talking about are significant cuts in Social Security benefits and benefits for disabled veterans. And I will continue to do everything I can to defeat those cuts. If if the so-called chain CPI were to go into effect, what it does is change how we formulate what cost of a living adjustments are for people who getting disability benefits, pension benefits if you're in the VA system, Social Security benefits. If you're 65 today and on Social Security, by the time you're 75, you would lose about $600 a year. By the time you are 85, you'd lose about $1,000 a year. That is a lot of money for somebody struggling to stay alive on $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 a year. So as chairman of the Defending Social Security Caucus, and as the incoming chairman of the Veterans Committee, I am going to do everything that I can to beat back that effort to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans benefits. We succeeded to do that in this fiscal cliff debate, but that effort is certainly going to resurface in the coming months. Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious your thoughts on the politics and the reality of of the next disaster that seems to the Republicans seem to be setting up, which is the debt ceiling.
All right, two points to be made. I thought the majority leader, Harry Reid, was strong in this fiscal cliff debate. I think apparently the White House thought he was too tough, too strong, and they kind of gave the assignment over to Biden, who, in my view, ended up making concessions that probably were not necessary. The most important concession is that Obama originally wanted $1.6 trillion in new revenue. What we ended up with was only 40% of that, about $620 billion. What we got is increased tax revenue from people making $400,000 a year or more, but we did not get any increased revenue from people making $250,000 a year or more, which is what Obama originally wanted. Now, the other thing that took place that I want to just briefly mention, and this is a total outrage, that the top 0.3% of Americans who pay estate taxes, it's a tiny number of people, few thousand people a year, few thousand families a year, received over a 10-year period a $100 billion tax break. $100 billion tax break. And that was tucked into that by virtually every Republican, and some Democrats wanted it. That was a total outrage. And so those are the very negative aspects of the bill, which really bothered me a whole lot. Now, where we are now is that because we brought in less revenue than we had wanted, Obama wanted $1.6 trillion, we got $620 billion, the result of that is our Republican friends are hell-bent now in going after Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, nutrition programs. And their argument is, we don't want to talk anymore about revenue. Mitch McConnell was on the floor of the Senate saying, the revenue discussion is over. Well, not for me. Not for me. The truth of the matter is that right now you have one out of four profitable corporations in America paying zero in federal taxes. The percentage of revenue that we get compared to GDP today in corporate taxes is much, much lower than it used to be. As I've mentioned many times, we're losing $100 billion a year from corporations and wealthy individuals who stash their money in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. We have just enormous loopholes that corporations and wealthy people continue to take advantage of. So where we are at, Tom, right now, is a huge and very, very significant philosophical debate. And that is whether or not we cut programs that working families and lower-income people desperately depend upon, or whether we ask the wealthiest people and largest corporations, all of whom are doing very, very well, to start paying their fair share of taxes. And I would remind every listener, and this is not talked about too much in Congress, or certainly not in the media, that the United States not only has the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, but also it is as bad today as it was, it is worse today than at any time since the late 1920s. Please remember that the top 1% in America owns 42% of the wealth. The bottom 60% own 2.3% of the wealth.
These are extraordinary, extraordinary numbers. Senator Bernie Sanders here with us for our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign a couple of really great petitions there. Sign up for his newsletter. Catch all the news of the day, sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And back with your calls, 866-987-THOM for Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back to Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Bernie, one of our free speech TV callers, was just asking, since 78 to today, productivity has gone up, wages have not gone up. Used to be one income could raise a home, could raise five kids. Now it can't. What's happened?
Well, Jim from New Jersey asked a terribly important question. And what he is really talking about is the disappearance of the working class and the middle class of this country, and a massive shift of wealth that goes to the very wealthiest people in this country. I mentioned earlier that in terms of distribution of wealth, and I want everybody to hear this because you don't hear it very often, but economically what we're looking at is the top 1% owns 42% of the wealth of America. The bottom 60%, 60, owns 2.3%. That's wealth. In terms of income, the last study that has been done on this issue was in 2010. 93% of all newly created income, new income, went to the top 1%. So what we are seeing, yes, we are a wealthy nation, but more and more of the wealth of the nation rests in the hands of fewer and fewer people. One other statistic. One family, the Walton family, that owns Walmart, owns more wealth than the bottom 40% of America combined. So for a variety of reasons, the decline of trade unions and the ability of working people to negotiate with their employers, unfettered free trade, in which employers have thrown millions of workers out on the street, moved their plants to Mexico, to China, to other low-wage countries, an aggressive class warfare being waged by the people who have money on the political front. So the minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation. Cutbacks in education. When I was growing up, you had educational systems in New York City, California, some of the best higher educational systems in the world, University of California, City University of New York, were virtually free. Now they're not free anymore. They're quite expensive. Young people leaving school deeply in debt. 40, 50 years ago, as Jim indicated, one worker, in those days most often the man, could work 40 hours a week, earn enough money to pay the bills. Now you need husband and wife working incredibly long hours in order to pay the bills. So you add all of that stuff together, what you're seeing, people on top doing phenomenally well, middle class disappearing, poverty at an all-time high. And with all of that wealth, what the big money interests have done is accumulate power, because you got a Citizens United decision out there which now lets them contribute as much as they want into the political process, owning a whole lot of politicians as well. So that is where we are politically and economically. That is the major issue facing our society. And the antidote to that is working people coming together to fight for a progressive agenda, which essentially says that in this great nation, all of our people should have a decent standard of living, and we should not have just some people on the top with more wealth than anyone could ever dream of, while so many people are struggling just to stay alive. And that is the issue of the day, in my view, Tom.
Sally, in New York City, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to WWRL.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Sanders, for all the stuff you do, especially defending the post office. I have a question about the post office. We used to have a postal bank, which, as I have found out a little bit, it seems to have been defunded but not abolished. We also have a government that pays a lot of benefits, and some of them are paid through benefit cards that are administered by the private banking system, which doesn't do it for free. They take a fee. I'm just wondering if we could take those government payments, revive the postal bank, run the whole thing through the postal bank, therefore we'd get the fees back, and all those post offices that people want to close would then become a great asset because they're everywhere, like ATMs.
Sally, thank you for that excellent and thoughtful question. The answer is I agree with you. It is an idea that has popped up. It has met severe opposition from Republicans and some Democrats. What I want to see happen, and I've been involved in this issue now for the last year or so, I want to see the Postal Service provide new services to people, become more important to our society, and maintain or grow jobs. There are other people who want to move it in a very different direction and essentially privatize it, shut down post offices, close processing plants. So one of the areas that I think post offices can play a role is to do exactly what Sally indicated. If you are, you know, an ordinary person or a lower income person, you know what? It's tough to get service through many banks, and the post office could play that role. So I think that's a great idea, Sally.
Yeah. Bernie, we have just a minute to the break here, not enough time to bring in a caller before the bottom of the hour. How goes the battle to save the post office?
We passed a reasonably good piece of legislation in the Senate. The House did not act, so that piece of legislation now no longer exists. And we will be reintroducing legislation in a couple of weeks to start the ball rolling again. I would suppose that the good news is that our right-wing friends were not successful in moving toward major, major cutbacks in postal post offices and processing plants and cutting back services. On the other hand, the Postal Service remains significantly troubled. Its most serious problem is the $5 billion every year it has to come up with for future retiree health plans. And the Senate bill basically eliminated that. So we're on a hold. The worst did not take place, and we've got a lot of work in front of us.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. In addition to his petition to undo Citizens United, there's a whole bunch of great information. Be sure to check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
More Brunch with Bernie after this, and in the next hour, have I got a deal for you? I'll tell you all about it top of the hour. Welcome back to Brunch with Bernie, our hour-long national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your questions. And, Senator, you're still with us?
Yep, there you are. I'm right here.
Okay. Jim, in Upland, Indiana, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Jim.
This is Jim, and I live out here in Upland, Indiana. I'm not too far south of where Tom used to live. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. And your question?
Oh, okay. I'm 68 years old, and I've seen a lot of things come and go in this country. And I served two tours in Vietnam while I was a lot younger. And my uncle and my granddad, they both served in one was in WPA and one was in 3Cs. Now, I don't remember anything about it because it was over and done with before I was born. But they both swore that that's what kept their families together and kept things going as young men. And I've read a lot about the WPA and the 3Cs, and there were a lot of things that went on other than just building roads and parks and so forth. As I understand it, there were a lot of artists, there were a lot of craftsmen. There was a lot of things that were built that we still see today that are still being used today. And I'm just wondering if something like this could be reintroduced. I think it would do two things. It would get a lot of structures built that need to be built, and it would also, I think, cut down on a lot of crime. There are a lot of guys out here that are desperate for jobs, and they're desperate for ways to feed their families and take care of themselves, and I think it would serve a twofold purpose. If we could get these guys into some kind of a structure, you know, even if it is tents and digging ditches and planting trees and painting buildings and so on and so forth. Is there any chance, and I've talked to Evan Bay and Dick Lugar in years gone by, and they've both thought it was a good idea, and I think both of them have talked it over with their constituents, but I don't know that there's been enough
Let's ask Bernie, Jim. Let's get to
it. Well, Jim, I think it's an excellent idea, but I doubt very much that Evan Bay or Dick Lugar would in fact vote for it, because this is Jim, exactly the debate that we're having. And you put it in very human terms. I suspect that most people who listen to what Jim said and understand that there's a lot of unemployment in this country, especially among younger people, We have a crumbling infrastructure. We need to deal with global warming and transform our energy system, all of which means there's an enormous amount of work to be done, that if we put young people on the payroll doing meaningful work, provide education to them as well, it could play a very profound role for their future career lives. I would say that most people would say, you know, Jim, you're making a lot of sense. And I agree. We are. But, Jim, the debate we're having right now in Congress, what you're talking about is a quote-unquote stimulus package. That's what it is, in a specific way. You're talking about rebuilding America and putting people to work. Our conservative friends, and I would say that probably Evan Bayh, who's no longer in the Senate, Dick Lugo, who's a friend, I don't know, I can't speak for him, probably would not be sympathetic because this means investing in America. What our Republican friends want to do is exactly the opposite. They want to cut spending. They want to cut education, not add new teachers, but lay off teachers. They do not want to fund the need to rebuild our infrastructure. So I agree with Jim, and that's what I believe, and that's what some of us are trying to do. I think most Americans understand that we have got to address the jobs crisis, and something like a CCC, or at the very least, putting substantial sums of money into rebuilding our infrastructure. That is our water systems, our wastewater plants, roads, bridges, our rail system, older schools, creating more solar and wind and geothermal and biomass projects. We could put millions of people to work doing that. But that requires an investment, and I'm afraid many of my conservative friends do not want to do that.
Rod in Jay, Maine. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. I just want to thank you very much, Tom, for all that you're doing. And, Senator, thank you very much for putting yourself out here and answering these questions and doing what you do. My big question, I'll get right to the point, is filibustering. I do not understand why we allow the fact that when we filibuster, we do not do a voice filibuster. This gets the issue out. This gets everybody discussing what needs to be done. At the same time, I have one other issue, is do we have the people that have enough fortitude to stand up and actually question these results if they do get them up? Or is everybody bought off pretty much the way they seem to be going with big corporations?
All right. Thanks, Rod, for that very important question. I know Tom in the break mentioned it in his comments. Here's where we are. Since Obama has been president, the Republicans have been in obstructionist mode. I think everybody acknowledges that. Mitch McConnell a couple of years ago was on the floor of the House or giving interviews saying our main goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president, make sure that, in so many words, to make sure that good legislation was not passed, because if we could bring the American economy down, it was less likely that Obama would be reelected. They have engaged in just a huge number of filibusters. There was a time, through gentlemen's agreement, if you like, 20, 30 years ago, even more recent than that, where the asking for a 60-vote majority was very, very unusual. Very unusual. When Lyndon Johnson, before he was vice president, was the majority leader, I think he had to deal with one filibuster. But since Obama has been president, we've had to deal with, I think, hundreds of them. So we need to end that nonsense. We need to end obstructionism. I strongly support the efforts of Senator Merkley and Senator Tom Udall to do what we call a talking filibuster. And that means rather than just saying, I object, or sending down notification that you object to legislation or nomination, you're going to have to get on the floor of the Senate yourself and with others and talk about that issue. And when that is happening, then the American people will get a better understanding of who's objecting and why. And I think it will result in far less obstructionism than is currently the case. Right now, I think it is fair to say the Senate is dysfunctional precisely because of that reason, and we've got to end it. And I strongly support filibuster reform. As Tom just mentioned a moment ago, what the majority leader did is, in a sense, called for a recess after the first day, which means that we will deal with this issue as soon as we return, which is right before the inauguration.
Matthew in Barboursville, West Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, how you doing? My question for the senator was, since there's a chance that some of the Supreme Court justices could be retiring soon, is there an actual possibility that the Citizens United ruling could be overturned?
Matthew, there is. I mean, there sure is. Citizens United was passed by a 5-4 vote by the Supreme Court about, as I said, 2.5 years ago. Do I think it is an issue that should be revisited? Absolutely. It is an enormously important issue, one of the worst decisions ever made by a Supreme Court. I have legislation in, others do, to overturn Citizens United. But, yes, I would expect that if we could have a non-Republican majority, I would hope and expect they would hear a case to overturn that very, very bad decision. I think anyone who has seen in recent years the enormous amount of corporate billionaire money that has gone into the political process understands how polluting that is to American democracy. So the answer to that one, Matthew, is yes.
William in Wheeler, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. And Tom, thanks for the opportunity to speak to you guys. Generally speaking, my question would be in regards to the Federal Reserve, which is going into its 100th year of existence in 2013. And my question for Senator Sanders is, what can be done to expose the truth of what the Federal Reserve truly is and its creation off of a wonderful place in Georgia called Jekyll Island, and the fact that it was done with J.P. Morgan and a handful of his constituents in secret, and that this economic debacle we're involved in at this point with his debt. The average person I talk to doesn't ever seem to ask the question, who do we owe the debt to? And I feel that the exposure of the fact of these secret societies that are behind a lot of this stuff needs to be exposed to the American public.
Okay. William, we just have a minute to the break. Let's let the senator respond to
well,
that.
William, I'm not much into conspiracy theory or secret societies. I think we know who runs America. It is our friends on Wall Street, nothing secret about it. When you look at the campaign contributions made by dozens of billionaire families, we know who they are, nothing secret about it. I mentioned earlier that we just gave some of the very richest people in this country $100 billion tax break over a 10-year period through the estate tax. No secret who these people are. So I don't think we need any conspiracy theory here. We know that the power in this country rests with the folks who have the money and on Wall Street. In terms of the Fed, let me just say this. What I have done in the last couple of years is to bring an audit to the Fed over the emergency financial period, and we also have some legislation in for significant reform of the Fed.
And that's a great start. Senator Bernie Sanders is on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Harbin program, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Sanders.Senate.gov for a great news source, a great newsletter, a lot of great resources there. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line, and Don in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. So I was telling your screener that I don't understand with such a disparity in income and property ownership and so forth that people are in this country aren't rioting in the streets. I mean, in the 1960s, I grew up, and it seemed like people would get out and riot over anything. I mean, just, you know, social, you know, I just don't understand it. Can somebody explain this to me? And why can't we rich tax these people out of their minds, these rich people, and then pay off, and then put that money in Social Security or Medicare or wherever we need to put it?
Don, that's an interesting question. And what Don is asking, and it's it's a question that all of us should be thinking about, is when you have a middle class which is disappearing, when you have record levels of poverty, when you have kids coming out of school deeply in debt, when you got 50 million people who have no health insurance, and at the same time when you have the people on top doing phenomenally well, and as I've mentioned before, top 1% owning 42% of the wealth of America, and in 2010, top 1% earning 93% of all new income. What Don is asking, where are the people? Why aren't millions of people standing up and saying to Congress, saying to the president, excuse me, that is not what America is supposed to be about. We need much more equality in terms of the distribution of wealth and income. Don, I don't know the answer to that. I think there are a lot of factors. First of all, the issue of income and wealth inequality is not talked about a whole lot. You can go to the House, you can go to the Senate, not a whole lot of people talk about it. I do, a few other people do, not a whole lot. The media doesn't talk about it. Media, of course, is controlled to a large degree and owned by these same large corporate interests. The other thing is that when people are desperate, they're working long hours. You know, you got people working 50, 60 hours, husbands, wives working. They don't have the energy to get involved in the political process. So, you know, there are a number of reasons why. But Don's point is that in order to change this, people do have to stand up. What I will tell you, there is no state in the country, not the most conservative state in the country, not Utah, not Oklahoma, not Mississippi, where people think that you cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and education, and you give tax breaks to the wealthy. Nobody believes that, except in the United States Congress, where people get huge campaign contributions from the wealthy and the large corporations. But if people begin to stand up and say, excuse me, enough is enough, Congress has to pay attention to the majority of the people of this country, the working families of this country, and not the billionaires who make campaign contributions. We can turn this thing around, Don. But that's what it requires. It requires people getting standing up. And now you don't have to riot on the streets. All you got to do is call up your congressman, call up your senator, email, let them know you are not going to stand by while they cut Social Security and other important programs.
Veronica in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. I appreciate the work you do. My question is this. If my Social Security check or my disability check is in the mailbox and somebody takes it from the mailbox and cashes it, that Social Security number is my account, and they go to jail. I have paid money into Social Security, into my account with my Social Security number, and now Congress is going to take my money away from me, the money that I've paid in. It doesn't seem legal. What are the legalities of people playing around with money that I've paid into? It's not an entitlement. It's money that I've paid into in case I get disabled or in case my husband should die or in case, do you understand?
Yes, I understand exactly.
What are the legalities of this?
Okay. Well, here's the debate. You know, what people will say, what the so-called chain CPI, which I believe will be the mechanism that they cut Social Security. I may be wrong. They may go in another direction. Veronica, what they would say to you is, look, there are different ways to determine what inflation is for seniors. In other words, what Congress did a number of years ago is they said, if inflationary costs, if there is inflation in terms of increased costs for what seniors buy, Congress will raise through COLAs their benefits. If inflation is 3%, they will get 3% more. What my conservative friends are saying is that the way we determine COLAs now is too, quote unquote, generous, and we should reconfigure how we determine these cost of living adjustments by being skimpier. So instead of people getting a 3% increase, maybe they get a 2.25% increase. You add that up over 30 or 40 years, that is a heck of a lot of money. So I don't know that it is illegal. I think it is cruel. I think it is a terrible thing to do to working families. And I think if we stand together, we can defeat that.
Bernie, we have about a minute and a half before the end of the hour. I'm curious your thoughts on the year going forward, where we're at, what we should be doing as a people.
Okay. Well, I think I've touched on, you know, some of the important issues, and the questions coming in today, Tom, were really great. Here's the issue. We live in a democracy, which means that the people are supposed to rule. And I can tell you that what the people want is unfortunately very different from what we have over in the Republican House, which is dominated by big money interests, and also different than we have here in the Senate. The people want large corporations and the wealthy to start paying their fair share in taxes in order to help us move toward deficit reduction and to invest in the economy. Jim from Indiana made that point. We need to invest in the economy and create jobs. That is what the people want. A majority of the people in this country understand that global warming is real, that global warming is significantly man-made. It is already causing significant damage. For the sake of the planet, we have got to invest in sustainable energy and cut back on greenhouse gas emissions. So bottom line is, Congress has got to start listening to the people of this country and not just the billionaires and the big campaign contributors.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Great, always great having you on. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. It's, of course, Anything Goes Friday, but please indulge me for a brief rant, and then we're going to throw it open to our throw our phone lines open and go in whichever direction our callers want. But there is some stuff in the news, and Bernie was talking about it to some extent. Let me frame it this way. Let's say that you're in your 20s. You're just starting out in life. One day, an insurance salesman walks up to your doorstep, toting his briefcase and wearing a cheap suit and a loud tie, and he rings the doorbell and smiles like a televangelist and says, "Have I got a deal for you?" He's pushing a brand new insurance program. He calls it Lifetime Disaster Insurance. He says, "For the rest of your life, you'll be covered whether you're a teenager, in your 20s, 30s, whatever age you are. This insurance protects you against anything. If you're disabled in a car accident, a mugging, any other sort of horror, this insurance policy will kick in and cover all of your medical expenses, your rent, your food, and pretty much everything else from the time you're injured until the day you die, even if you live to 100. You look at him skeptically, but unfazed, he continues. He says, "Not only will this insurance plan cover you, but it'll also cover your spouse and kids. If something terrible happens to you, then your spouse and your children will be covered and cared for as part of this insurance plan. And if something happens to any of them, their medical bills and the cost of feeding, clothing, and housing them will be covered too, forever. Not only that," he continues, "if you have a child with a birth defect, God forbid, that requires lifelong care, this insurance plan will cover all the medical expenses and all the cost of living expenses for your child from birth to death, even if your kid lives to 90 and you're long gone." Sales pitch sounds too good to be true, right? I don't think most, 20-somethings even know that such insurance is available. An insurance plan that covers you, your spouse if you happen to get married, your kids if you have them, for life? It can never be revoked, including your living expenses? I mean, even if it is true, something like that would have to cost a fortune, right? So you're about to ask the salesman the important question, well, how much does it cost? $500 a month? $1,000? $2,000? And then it dawns on you, if you're well informed, you don't need this insurance plan. You already have it. It's called Social Security. You and every other American from birth to death already have it. And the best part about it is that it's completely free. Even if you're just getting out of school and never worked a day in your life and thus never paid any payroll taxes, you still have this vital insurance. You're entitled to it from the moment you're born until the day you die, which is why it's called an entitlement. But now the bad news. There are people in America today who want to take that insurance policy away from you and give it to their billionaire buddies on Wall Street. In Dwight Eisenhower's day, we referred to these people as stupid, just as Eisenhower did. But today, these people run the Republican Party. People like Paul Ryan, John Boehner, Marco Rubio, Eric Cantor. Even worse, retired political hacks like cat food commissioners Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, two guys who now charge $40,000 an hour in speaking fees, are pushing hard to kill Social Security by handing it off to Wall Street, even though Social Security is sitting at a $2.7 trillion surplus. Fortunately, their efforts to cut or privatize Social Security aren't working. According to a new poll by the Pew Research Center, Americans aged 30 to 49 by a margin of 52 to 35% believe preserving Social Security insurance is more important than reducing the deficit. And younger Americans share that sentiment by a margin of 48 to 41%. Americans in the 18 to 29 age group believe preserving Social Security is more important than deficit reduction. And keep in mind, Social Security has nothing to do with the deficit. But don't expect the polls to slow down the Republicans and the cat food commissioners. If they can whip up enough phony fear and convince enough younger Americans that their retirement is in jeopardy, even though retirement funds only account for two-thirds of Social Security, fully a third of Social Security is people who are injured, wounded, widows, orphans, disabled kids. That's a third of Social Security. But if they can convince people, oh, it's unsustainable, then they might even succeed in turning Social Security insurance over to Wall Street. Because that's their ultimate goal. Instead of free, lifetime disaster insurance guaranteed by our government, available to every 20-year-old in America, every 10-year-old in America, every 30-year-old, it doesn't matter what your age is. Social Security is not just for old people. Instead of having this program guaranteed by our government, conservatives want Wall Street to own Social Security's $2.7 trillion trust fund. Banksters like Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon are drooling at the chance to get their grubby hands on those trillions and go buck wild in the markets with it, skimming billions off the top in fees. And once Wall Street gets their hands on Social Security insurance, then you actually will be meeting insurance salesmen in loud ties, hustling the very same disaster insurance plan that you have right now for free. Only this time, they'll charge you lots of money for it. The fear-mongering over Social Security insurance, led mostly by extremely rich people, is the biggest scam being run right now in America. Spread the word. No more cat food commission. Marlene in Morriston, Florida. Hey, Marlene. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Thanks for taking my call. Your intellect, your integrity, and your history is so just, I love listening to you.
Well, thank you.
I'm calling regarding the amendments to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. I would like to know what purpose do they serve if they're not utilized. And for example, President Obama has already said that he doesn't want to use the 14th Amendment to resolve the debt ceiling crisis. I mean, it's a tool that, you know, we need to use everything we possibly can in trying to combat these people who are trying to undermine our government.
Yeah. Well, it may be that he doesn't want to do it because doing so would throw it to the Supreme Court almost immediately. And the Supreme Court is dominated by five right-wing crazies who may just say, well, that was just about the Civil War and paying off the war debts and trying to reassure the creditors, to the union, which is really what it was. But
are you saying then that the amendments that we have to the Constitution are vulnerable to their decisions?
Oh, yeah, Michael Keaton said in
and they're part of our Constitution.
Yeah. Well, you know, the First Amendment says that you and I have the right to free speech. The same right-wing wackadoodles on the Supreme Court said, well, no, corporations are persons. They have the right to free speech. It says that, you know, we have the right of freedom of religion in the United States. The Seventh Circuit Court this week, maybe it was last week, but just in the last few days, the last week or so, has said that corporations have the right to have their religious freedom right? A corporation can have a religion. You can't see a corporation. You can't talk to a corporation. A corporation is a legal fiction. It is, at best, a piece of paper signed by the Secretary of State or by their representatives saying that you can get certain tax breaks if you do business in a certain way. And yet this can have a religion. So, yeah, this Supreme Court is one of the most activist Supreme Courts that we have seen, certainly since Earl Warren and arguably since Dred Scott, since the Roger Taney Supreme Court back in 1856, when the Supreme Court said that people were property in the Dred Scott case. I mean, this is the court that said that property is people and, you know, the corporations are people. And the flip side, the mirror image of Dred Scott. So it could be that. It could be that, or it could be that, you know, I mean, he's said a number of things, you know, hey, we're gonna tax people making over $250,000, and then he compromised to $400,000. Maybe he'll compromise on this by saying, well, yeah, okay, we're gonna go with the constitutional option. Marlene, I don't know the answer. You know, I'm not inside Obama's head, but I agree with you. It's there, it should be used. Thank you for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out our new app over at the Tom Hartman Program, tomhartman.com. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Wanda listening on WCPT in Ottawa, Illinois. Hey, Wanda, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, when you were talking to Senator Sanders and talking about, you know, our elections and that type of thing, I ran in the last congressional race. I ran against a cheap labor conservative, Adam Kinzinger.
Good on you.
In Illinois. Yeah. I've never ran for office in my life. We were drawn as a giveaway to the Republican Party, and no one ran in the primary. And so I had to do it the hard way and get on the ballot. I refused to take any kind of PAC money or anything like that. We ended up only spending 41 cents per vote. We were only supposed to get 29% of the vote, and we got 38.6.
Wow.
We did really well, and I was very impressed with that. Yeah, but I came to the realization that unless we really do get public financing for our elections, we will continue to get nothing but what we have. Yeah. You know, when you were talking about the Social Security thing, almost 10 years ago, I had a full-time job and a part-time job. I had private health insurance. I had an ATV accident, and it left me paralyzed for the rest of my life.
Ouch.
And
sorry.
I lost everything. You know, I didn't get to, you know, see like Mark Kirk, you know, yesterday walking up the steps to a job he got to keep, to a salary he got to keep. That doesn't happen to the average person.
Right.
They lose everything.
Right.
But I did it the way you're supposed to. And I went to school, and I got a master's degree. I'm now a licensed social worker. I work in hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not on any of those programs, but I had to use them all. And the hate that I heard during you know, running was, you know, everybody on welfare is lazy. Everybody's working the system, and you still hear it. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to cut, cut, cut. I don't get it. We are so wrong in our thinking that we're hiring people who say they hate government to run the government, and
yep.
they're running it into the ground.
Yep.
And until we change our campaign finance laws, we will continue to have nothing but this problem. And
we've
got to change the redistricting.
I agree. And public financing of campaigns requires some regulation of private financing of campaigns in order to work. And the ability to do that was destroyed by Citizens United. And so step one is to repeal Citizens United, whether it's done by a change in the makeup of the Supreme Court or whether it's done by you know, a citizens' grassroots effort to amend the Constitution, which, frankly, I think is the way to do it, because I'm concerned that even if, you know, one reasonable progressive or even a middle-of-the-road Democrat gets appointed to the Supreme Court, Citizens United comes before them again. Instead of totally repealing it, instead of repudiating not just Citizens United, but the earlier decisions upon which it stands, Buckley versus Vallejo, First National Bank versus Bilotti, and I mean, arguably all the way back to Santa Clara County, unless that's done, which it would be done by a constitutional amendment, then, you know, we're still going to end up with a dysfunctional system where corporations and billionaires can largely run and control not just our elections, but our politicians once they're elected. But I'm totally with you, Wanda, and God bless you for running for political office. It's marvelous. Thank you for the call. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. It's good to have you again this year. And I just wanted to ask, you know, on this federal debt ceiling and, you know, we're borrowing money from China and other foreign countries.
We're borrowing most of it from ourselves, actually. The vast majority of the U.S. debt is money that the government has borrowed. Several trillion of it has been borrowed from the Fed. $2.5 trillion of it has been borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. A couple of trillion dollars of it is treasury bills that are owned by people like the Bush family, so that they, you know, when one of their children is born, they give them $1 million trust fund that's made up of treasury bills. So most of it we're borrowing from ourselves.
So my, you answered one part of my question. So what little I can do, should I buy savings bonds? Should I invest in the U.S. Mint and buy some gold and silver?
What you should do is work to get politicians elected who will stimulate the economy. We will pay off this debt if we could simply get our economy in gear. There were a number of very good pieces of legislation 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, back when Nancy Pelosi ran the House of Representatives, that came out of the House of Representatives that changed our insane trade policies. For example, right now, when Bain Capital sold off Sensata and literally dismantled that factory, that auto parts manufacturer in Ohio or Illinois, wherever they are, dismantled that factory and shipped it brick by brick off to China and rebuilt it there, that they got a tax break for that. Now, in fact, under the new tax law that was just passed, this fiscal cliff piece of legislation, any money that they make over there, they don't have to pay U.S. taxes on any longer. That was a big giveaway to the corporations. So Nancy Pelosi had passed legislation that would have ended the tax break for offshoring our jobs and that would have put into place a tax break for companies that bring jobs back home. Guess what happened? It got to the United States Senate. It would have gotten more than 51 votes. It would have gotten more than 51% of the vote. It would have passed by the measure defined by the Constitution for legislation passing in the Senate, which is 50 votes, 50% vote. It would have won. It would have passed. But a Republican senator said, no, I am putting a hold on this bill, and it got killed. And we don't even know which senator it was, because under the filibuster rules right now, you know, any senator can simply say, that's it, kill that bill, and it dies. And that's what Jeff Merkley is all about trying to reform, and it's why you need to call both of your senators in Texas, even though they're Republicans, you need to call both of your senators in Texas and say, please work to reform the filibuster.
How much are we borrowing per person, if you could come up with a number?
Well, you know, it really doesn't matter. Back during World War II, after World War II, when we came out of World War II, our debt-to-GDP ratio was much worse than it is right now. It's 127% of GDP. Right now, it's about 100% of GDP. Maybe if you take out the Social Security Trust Fund, it's around 68-70% of GDP. And that's a reasonable thing to do, because that's really not money that's borrowed. It's invested. And so, what we did, how did we get out of that? You know, you could have said back then, oh my God, everybody owes, you know, if you take our debt and you distribute it across all the people, everybody's debt is greater than, you know, their 5-year income. But we paid it off. We paid it off rather quickly by stimulating the economy, by putting people back to work. So the people who were draining money out of the government and making the debt worse by taking unemployment benefits and other benefits started putting money into the government and making the debt better by having a job and paying taxes. So this is a problem that we have solved many times in the past. It's very easy to solve, and you don't solve it by cutting. You solve it by putting people back to work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. I got to tell you, I want to get into the J curve. We'll do after that after the break. Okay, here's the, by the way, the numbers I was ranting about a little earlier about the teachers thing from the article in the Washington Post. I need to put my reading glasses on when I read from the screen. I was pulling off the numbers. The 61,000 number was the number of people who have in each country are downloading some scientific articles. Here's the more important number. And in fact, I'll give it in context. Martin Brady is writing about this. He says, but here's the problem. Kids don't come with barcodes. He starts out by talking about how, you know, you go to a Walmart and they scan everything. Once they scan it, it instantly updates inventory and everything else, and we know all about what's going on in the store. The management does. Well, here's the problem. Kids don't come with barcodes, writes Marion Brady. and teachers don't have scanners. Nancy Creech, the Michigan kindergarten teacher who recently told her story here on the answer sheet, this is in the Washington Post, summarized a consequence of data collection mandates. Authorities in her state, unwilling to trust her professional judgment, require her to give more than 27,000 grades or marks to her 4- and 5-year-olds. That number, evenly distributed over the school year, would require her to take a data-related action every 2 minutes of every school day. We've gone nuts in this country. So, and the question in my mind is, do charter schools have to do the same? And I frankly don't know the answer to that question. It's something I'd like to drill into. James Chowning Davies, and I realize it's anything goes Friday. I'm going to get back to your calls. I know the board is totally slammed, but I wanted to lay this out because we had a caller in the previous hour who asked Senator Sanders, who said words to the effect of, you know, I was born back in the 60s or I was alive in the 60s and I remember the 70s. You know, there were all these riots and people were saying enough already. We're not going to take it anymore. And why aren't people rioting now? And I would like to share my take on that. I mean, Bernie had his own and it was, I think he was spot on. But here's, or and here, let me add my take on this as well, on that question. Not on Bernie's answer, but on that question. Most of the people who were rioting in the 70s, and I lived through this. In fact, the neighborhood of Detroit that burned down, about 10 square blocks that burned down, is where I lived when I was 1 and 2 years old, when I was a little kid. It was a very poor neighborhood when it burned down. It was a very poor neighborhood when I lived there. My parents had just gotten married. Or they've been married for a year or so, a couple of years. And dad was, you know, traveling around the state looking for work. It was a tough time. This was 53, it must have been, 52, 53. And it was basically a Jewish ghetto. It was a community that was mostly immigrants, mostly German immigrants, Holocaust survivors and whatnot. And, in fact, the first language that I spoke with any reasonable fluency was not English. It was Yiddish, because both my parents were working, and the couple across the hall watched me during the day, and they spoke Yiddish. And so now it's funny. I go to Germany or I go to Israel, and I speak a little bit of German, and I speak a little bit of Hebrew. And when I speak it, my accent, the Hanukkah, you know, the ability to make those sounds is like absolutely natural to me because I learned it when I was 2 years old. I make those, and people just assume that I'm much more fluent than I actually am because my pronunciation is pretty amazing, or pretty good, let's say. It's not, certainly not amazing. So anyhow, I remember when Detroit burned. I remember when that neighborhood burned. And when that neighborhood went down in flames, it was entirely African-American. As was Watts, as was Harlem. I mean, you had cities across America that were burning, and they were African-American communities. Why? And this is, you know, it begs the question, again, why was Greece on fire last year? Now, there wasn't so much of a racial divide, but why was Greece on fire? James Chowning Davies, who was born in 1918, and as far as I can tell is still alive, he was a professor at the University of Oregon for quite some time, came up with a theory of revolutions, which has been incorporated into and referred to as the J-curve by a variety of people. And basically what he said was that revolution doesn't come about when life is terrible for people. Instead, revolution comes about when people not just expect, but believe, deep down inside believe, that life is going to get better or is getting better, and it doesn't happen. That's when you have revolution. So, you know, let's apply this to the United States. I mean, African Americans had pretty miserable lives for large chunks of American history, and there were some efforts at revolution, but nothing as large or as sustained as the 70s, but that was certainly a flashpoint. Why? Because in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court said no more segregated schools, no more legal apartheid in the United States. And then in 1966, 67, 68, there was a series of civil rights laws, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, that said, no, you can't keep, you know, you can't segregate people in commerce. This was actually part of the 1960s Nixon-Kennedy debate. We've played that clip before. And, in fact, it might be worth revisiting just so you get a sense of what this, what the time was like. So you understand what I'm saying here. Where Richard Nixon, you know, the question was, what are we going to do about the fact that the South in particular is segregated? You know, what's the deal with the segregated South? And Nixon said, you know, and the questioner in the debate said, what would you do about this? And Nixon basically said, I would ask the businessmen to stop being bad. And Kennedy said, I would use the law and kick their butt. And that was the big, you know, that historically has been the difference in conservatives and between Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals. Do you have a clip? Yeah, it's from the Nixon-Kennedy debate. Let's play it and see if that's the clip.
I am proposing today a new national health strategy.
No, that's not it. No. I think it's titled Nixon-Kennedy debate, but or 1960 debate. But in any case, I told you the story about it, so you don't have to hear it. So what had happened as a consequence of this, I mean, this has been part of the presidential debate in 1960. The Supreme Court decision was in 1954. You had the Civil Rights Acts passed throughout the 60s. You had the Great Society programs that lifted a quarter to a half of all the people in America in poverty, out of poverty. And so there was this level of expectation in the African-American community that within a generation, you know, within a decade, within a very short period of time, we're going to start seeing that same middle class life that white America had for the previous 20, 30 years. And it didn't happen because redlining was still happening. Discrimination was still happening. Racism was alive and well. The Republicans were making a comeback. Nixon had come up with his Southern strategy. I mean, it was just the whole thing. And so you had a mini revolution. You look at the same thing. You can go back to the French Revolution. The French Revolution wasn't about starvation. Yeah, times were tough, but they've been far tougher at other times. It was about the expectation. They had seen our revolution. They had seen an American middle class, and they said, why can't we have that? In fact, they fully expected that. Louis XVI essentially promised it to them, and they didn't get it. The same thing with the Greeks. The Greeks, you know, they were expecting the life was going to, you know, every generation is going to do better than the previous generation. Then the banksters come along and crash their economy. And then to add insult to injury, the banksters say, by the way, we're not paying for the damage we did. Average working people have to pay for the damage we did. And so not only did life get better, it got worse. But it wasn't that what life got worse. It was that the expectation was violated. Now, this is a very back of the envelope, super simplistic perspective. But the important point is that revolution happens, sometimes violently, sometimes nonviolently. And I would say that the revolution of 1932 is an example of nonviolent revolution. You know, the election of Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal. The revolution happens when it's basically provoked or happened. I mean, you argued the actual revolution happened in 1930, 31. When the occupation movement of that generation, when the Bonus Army camped out from the White House all the way down to the Potomac River and said, we're not going to leave. And finally, in 1931, President Herbert Hoover, maybe it was 32, President Herbert Hoover had General Eisenhower and General, what's his name from the Pacific Theater, Westmoreland? No. General MacArthur. Ride in there with tanks and horses, and a couple of people had died, and they burned them out, basically. I mean, they did away with that Occupy movement. That was the revolution. The response to that revolution was the New Deal. So the question in my mind is, at what point are people's expectations, particularly given the election of a president who campaigned on hope and change and who has been promising that things are going to get better, when he is confronted by an absolutely immovable Republican Party that says, no, we are going to block anything that makes things better. every single significant piece of legislation in the first 2 years of the Obama presidency that successfully got out of the House of Representatives that would have helped the economy were blocked by Republicans in the Senate. And then for the last 2 years of the Obama presidency, the Republicans controlled the House, and not one single jobs bill was passed. Instead, we saw legislation about gay marriage and to repeal Obamacare. And now the same thing. The first bill that was introduced in the House of Representatives yesterday by Michelle Bachmann was to repeal Obamacare. How long is it going to be before people's expectations collide with reality?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In my opinion, if the Republicans continue this obstruction, it's going to be within the next year or two or three at the most. Okay, let's check into the news for the day. Our newscast from the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria Jones on the line with us. Victoria, what's going on? Hey, first of all, hi.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to see you.
I'm going to dwell very briefly on two stories that are out there, and you may have talked about extensively, but the unemployment rate stayed the same this month at 7.8%. It was, in fact, 7.8% in November. It never was 7.7%, and 155,000 new jobs were created in the private sector. Government jobs dipped slightly.
Mm-hmm.
The White House said today, Alan Krueger, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisers, said it's quite clear the economy will be better if Congress does its job, does what it routinely has done historically, which is raise the debt limit without problem. The interesting thing about that is that he says if Congress does its job, that you can see that as a distancing of the White House from the issue.
Well, that's interesting. Yes.
I think it is. Also, NBC reporting that multiple sources on Capitol Hill and in key special interest groups involved in national security issues say they've been told to be prepared for a Chuck Hagel nomination for defense secretary, either as early as Monday or perhaps more likely Tuesday of next week.
We've heard for some time this is coming down the road, and that'll be very interesting. I've on the one hand, I'm sad that it seems like every Democratic president feels like they have to put a Republican in charge of defense. On the other hand, and I have a personal animus toward Chuck Hagel because he used to be the CEO of the company that became ES&S Voting Machine Company. But, all that aside, he was a decent senator, and he certainly knows foreign policy. He's very good at it. He's a decorated war veteran, and you have to give him his due. I'm curious who's going to replace Tim Geithner. I heard that it was going to be Mr. Liu, the chief of staff, the Obama chief of staff.
Well, he is the favorite to replace Geithner, who is expected to leave at the end of January. Geithner has wanted to leave for some time. He was persuaded to stay, but he is definitely going. Bloomberg was the first to report this. Jack Liu is the one. Now, Bloomberg reported that Liu's market experience is considered what Bloomberg called thin, and so that Obama might go to a Wall Street executive or somebody like that for a deputy Treasury secretary.
Well, wait a second. Jack Liu, yeah, was an old-fashioned progressive Democrat and was very involved in Democratic activities, but he was also worked for Citicorp, wasn't it, for a couple of years? He ran a hedge fund.
Yeah, but Bloomberg still considers that his actual market experience is thin.
Because he was an executive, not a trader.
That seems to be what they're thinking. They just don't. They don't think.
Why does anybody have to have market experience? I mean, why?
I don't know.
Anyway.
I don't know. Also, the other interesting issue with him, it's not a spoiler, but it's an interesting issue. Republicans don't like him very much. They've negotiated with him, and they don't like the way he negotiates.
Good.
So he would be the point man on raising the debt limit, the government shutdown, all these issues coming around the corner.
Rather than little Timmy Geithner, who used to be a Republican, probably still is.
But they found him pretty tough to deal with, too.
Yeah. Well, he was just being rational about things. And with this modern Republican Party, that doesn't get you very far.
No, very interesting. So it's an interesting development. But he is the favorite. I don't hear other names. There may be others, but we haven't heard them so far.
Mm.
Also today, the FDA finally is moving ahead with the first major revamping of the nation's food safety system in more than 70 years.
Wow.
Two pretty sweeping rules aimed at preventing the contamination of produce and processed foods. Mm. Now, it's been very controversial because the law was passed 2 years ago. It's taken the FDA 2 years to get these rules in place. This will really be produce, dairy, and seafood, beef, poultry, and eggs of the Department of Agriculture. But the first rule would require manufacturers of processed food sold in the U.S. to identify, adopt, and carry out measures to reduce the risk of contamination. They'd also have to have a plan for correcting any problems that might arise and for keeping records. And the FDA could actually drop in and inspect them. The other rule, this sounds so obvious, would apply to the harvesting and production of fruit and veg in an effort to combat bacterial contamination that's arisen over the last decade, like dying. It would address what advocates refer to as the four W's, water, waste, workers, and wildlife. A plant or farm where vegetables are packed might add lavatories to ensure that workers do not urinate in fields and post signs similar to those in restaurants that remind employees to wash their hands. There is no legal requirement that they even consider doing so.
Wow. Now, I mean, that's pretty common sense for field workers in the United States, but increasingly the American food supply, including fresh fruits and vegetables, is not grown in the United States. Is there any kind of oversight on imported foods?
Additional rules are pending, including one that would cover importers' responsibilities to verify the safety of food products grown or made overseas. About 15% of food eaten by Americans imported, and an even higher percentage of produce comes from abroad. So it's pending. And new rules are also needed for animal feed, which is going to be similar to those for human food. And the quote from the FDA is, "We're hoping to get them done very soon." We don't know what their definition of very soon is. Things they took 2 years to get this done.
Right, and 70 years to get any major change. But once it is done, you know what's going to happen is you're going to have the Koch brothers funding a whole bunch of front groups out there going on NPR and every place else going, "The Obama administration has promulgated thousands of new regulations. Oh, no, the sky is going to fall." Oh, well.
Until everybody drops dead from Cantaloupe.
Yeah, right.
And then nobody's going to listen to them anymore.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure everybody listens to them now, but in any case.
Not on things like this, I don't think so.
Yeah. What else
is people want regulations on their food.
They do.
They do.
I do.
I do.
I'd like labeling, too, that tells me if it's got GMO in it. What else is going on?
I do, too. Sandy Aid passed today in the House, $9.7 billion for flood insurance. 67 Republicans voted against, including some in disaster-stricken areas like guy in Mississippi who got hit by Katrina.
Oh my.
Somebody in Maryland on the eastern shore that got pummeled by Sandy, but they voted against nevertheless.
Now, does this have to go to the Senate, and which isn't in session for 3 weeks?
No, it's been passed by the Senate.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's just jump into Anything Goes Friday here. Neil in San Antonio, Texas. You had a question about the NDAA? Neil? Come on, Neil. Okay, I'm going to put Neil on hold because he's been waiting for a long, long time. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike. You had a question about people earning over $700,000 a year.
Yeah, I'm actually calling to complain about a couple of complainers you had on about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
They were talking about how the new tax rate was going to hurt them financially, even though that they're in that.
Yeah, there was a guy who called who was making $300,000 a year, and basically what I said was, you know, you're not the problem, and so, you know, I understand you. And then some guy called and says, "Well, I make $700,000." I said, "You're not the problem." And they're really not the problem. I think they should pay more taxes. And I don't think 3% is going to kill them. And Bill O'Reilly thinks it's enough that he's going to stop doing radio and TV or doing TV. But you know, in my dreams, right? He won't. But the real problem are the Mitt Romneys and the Paris Hiltons of the world who are paying a maximum of 20% income tax.
I understand, but I'm just irritated at the fact that the one who was making $700,000 was saying, you know, he's going to be hurting so bad, because, and he had a modest home, a modest car, modest by whose standards?
Yeah, exactly.
Wasn't able to look at the Maserati, but he was able to look at the Mercedes.
There you go.
I mean, give me $700,000 a year, I'll have my house paid off and my kids' tuition paid off for the next 4 years.
Yep.
No problem.
There you go.
I mean, it's basically a situation that they that a lot of people say to everyone else, you're living beyond your means.
Yeah.
If you got $700,000 and you're going to be hurting with a, you know, a little tick in your 3% or so on your income tax, that's, I'm sorry.
Meanwhile, working people are seeing their payroll taxes go up 2%. And like Bernie said, I mean, it's actually a good thing, because it never should have dropped in the first place. It was hurting Social Security. But on the other hand, you know, working people are going to see their taxes. If they make under $110,000 a year, they're going to see their payroll taxes go up 2%. And a guy making $700,000 on roughly $600,000 of his income, he's not going to pay a penny in Social Security taxes. And I think he should be paying the full load.
I had a question in regards to that.
Go for it.
You had mentioned yesterday about how Reagan fixed the Social Security problem by increasing the that tax.
He doubled it.
People like, pardon?
He doubled it.
He doubled it, right. How long was that supposed to last?
Oh, it's not built into the law or into the code that it undoes itself at any particular point in time. The assumption was that sometime in the 2040s, 2050s, 2060s, when the boomers die out, if there was not another baby boom generation that followed, in other words, another rabbit going through the python kind of problem, that gradually Social Security payments would be lowered, because from every single year, it used to be that every year the Social Security rate would be determined by how much they were paying out, because Social Security always operated on a break-even basis, and that they would simply return to that break-even basis. And what that would mean is that, you know, when there's more young people in the working place and fewer elderly retired and fewer people drawing Social Security disability, that the Social Security income tax, or the Social Security tax, the payroll tax, would go back down again. So it didn't need a statutory definition, I don't think, you know, to do that. Okay, makes sense?
Thanks
a lot, Mike. I appreciate the call. Laura in Chicago. Hey, Laura, you wanted to talk about fracking?
Hey. Yes, I do. I do. Thanks so much, Tom. Yeah, it's Anything Goes Friday, right?
There you go.
So this is not the fiscal cliff, but this is the environmental cliff. We are facing an environmental cliff. Everything I've read about global warming says that we have about 5 to 7 years to turn this ship around, and then it's goodbye New York City and the East Coast.
Yeah.
And so we're really fighting hard here in Illinois for a moratorium on fracking. Because fracking, some of the studies have showed that fracking releases 9,000 times the amount of methane, a global greenhouse gas, than they had estimated earlier, because about 50% of the wells will leak.
Yeah.
Some of them will leak right away, and then some of them will get old and the cement gets crusted and then they start leaking. But 50% of them will end up leaking. I think it's within 5 years.
Well, plus there's leakage all along the way.
Right. Plus there's leakage all around the way. That's exactly right. So there's this huge global greenhouse release from fracking.
Yeah. And methane is 18 times, as I recall, 1,800% more of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
That's exactly right. So fracking is no better than burning coal. That's a lateral shift.
Yeah.
They're both just, you know.
I'm not sure I would make that statement, because if it's producing the same amount of greenhouse gases, or even more greenhouse gases in the form of methane, the upside of it, if you want to call it that, or the flip side of that argument, is that methane in the atmosphere degrades down to carbon dioxide in a period of anywhere from 5 to 25 years, because it's a fairly large organic molecule. It just breaks down to carbon dioxide eventually, and thus becomes a much less potent greenhouse gas. And at the same time, when you're burning coal, you're releasing not just those greenhouse gases, but you're putting all this particulate matter into the air, including mercury and other heavy metals and radioactive metals, and you're creating these oceans, these lakes of coal ash, which are radioactive and toxic and deadly, and frankly, I think that there is much of, and in many ways, arguably a worse threat to environmental threat to the United States and health threat to the United States than nuclear waste.
Well, the deal is that fracking brings up radioactive waste, too. The flow back in the water, the millions of gallons of water that they're putting down there, 50% of it comes back, and half of that is radioactive as well.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of radon in it in particular.
I don't think, Tom, I honestly do not think we can judge those. That's like trying to, compare apples with oranges.
Well, it's kind of, Laura, like saying, it's kind of like saying, which is worse, being stabbed to death with a knife or being shot to death with a .22. And, in either case, it's like, well, hey, I'd rather not die. What we need to be doing is instead of, comparing fracking to burning coal, we need to be comparing both of them to putting up solar panels on the roof of every house in America, decentralizing our power systems, building smart grids to balance that power that's being generated, putting wind farms and windmills in areas where there's a lot of wind, putting electric gathering stations off the coast. We've got large geothermal areas in the United States as well, where we can do like Iceland. I mean, Iceland, 98% of all their electricity and all their heat is coming geothermal. It's coming out of the volcano that island sits on. And we could be doing that same thing. They're doing it increasingly in Hawaii now. And it's just crazy that we're not. Laura, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Your point was really, really well made. I appreciate it. Steve in River Forest. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Whenever we listen to neocons speak, there's always an implied false assumption that individual liberty is the answer to every problem. And it's false because the individual cannot survive or achieve happiness without society.
Brilliantly so.
This is their Achilles heel.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, Ayn Rand went so far as to say there is no such thing as society. It's only an aggregation of individuals. And she's absolutely upside down. It is completely backwards. You could argue that there's no individual without a society. Without a society, the individual died. Davy Boone, Daniel Crockett, whatever metaphor you want to use, they couldn't exist. We got a great John Kennedy quote on that one, too. They couldn't exist without the society around them. And even when they went out in the woods, they had to take things that came from society and they had to come back to society. So, excellent point, Steve. Excellent point. Thank you very much. It's the ultimate, talking point back to libertarians. Libertarians who think that, if only the individual, they'll like to quote Adam Smith, and they forget that the first dozen or so words of that sentence that involves the invisible hand in Adam Smith's Wealth of the Nation, 1776, was by preferring domestic to foreign manufacturers.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So Adam Smith was basically talking about protectionism. Hey, protectionism is a good thing. It produces the invisible hand. Oh, really? Somebody, quick, call the Koch brothers and tell them. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program, and DiCarlo in Oakland, California. Hey, DiCarlo. It's a myth that women are being suppressed by men. Really?
Well, no, I'm not saying it's a myth. I'm saying, look, if you look at the example that we have right now, you have 20 female senators. You have an...
And how many male senators do you have?
Well, no. How many people of color senators do you have? That's the question.
Frankly, I'm sorry. Zero, as far as I know. Oh, there's one. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's an appointee.
Yeah, so that's the only reason I'm saying that. I'm not saying that women aren't suppressed. I'm just saying that, to me, it's like, okay, now wait a second. You have white women are behind white men in Fortune 500 companies. They're now behind men in the government. So how is it that they're being suppressed when there are no people of color, primarily, except for one? I'm sorry.
Well, what you've identified, DiCarlo, is the reality of racism in our society, and as well as sexism. And in fact, here's the question beyond that question is how many African American women or women of color are represented, or an even bigger one as the Native Americans who watch this program, and we get calls from Indian reservations and whatnot. People say, you know, how many? We were the guys who occupied this continent first. How many Native Americans are there?
And I agree. I agree. I wholeheartedly agree because that is, I think that's one of the biggest problems here is that we continue to have this myth. It's like, oh, okay, well, here, they're being, you know, women are being suppressed so harshly. And they're in the highest positions of power. They're at the highest echelons of power.
Yeah, some of them are, yeah. But I think the largest point, if you really want to, you know, step back and look at this from 30,000 feet, I mean, look back at the last, you know, 600 years. What has really happened is that a violent, sexist, racist culture emerged out of Europe, out of Northern Europe and Northwestern Europe, and occupied the Americas and devastated the indigenous populations and brought in slaves of other indigenous populations from, it devastated the indigenous populations of the Americas, brought in people from Africa, and in the process, you know, I would say brutalized themselves to some extent, but in the process produced hundreds of years of echo of that, you know, Columbus bragging about, you know, how he murdered people to keep them in line and his Manuel de Cordoba, actually, I think he was the priest who was with them on the mission talking about how, you know, sex slaves, you know, the Tiano women, young women were being sold off and given to Columbus's soldiers as sex slaves and all this kind of thing. That patriarchy, hierarchy, and white dominance, white supremacy have been at the core of this culture since its founding, you know, the modern American culture. And we're at the core of European culture maybe since the early Caucasians drove the Neanderthals to existence. I mean, who knows? But
you're right.
You know,
well,
I don't have a solution for any of this other than, you know, I suspect what will happen to us is the same thing that happened to Native Americans 10 or 20,000 years ago when they populated North America and created an environmental disaster for themselves by wiping out the large mammals and then they figured out, hey, we can't live this way, you know, and they figured out how to live in balance with their society and did so, you know, most of them. And the ones that didn't survive, and the ones that did lasted for you know, hundreds if not thousands of years. The Iroquois Confederacy is probably one of the most famous with their story of the I can never remember the guy's name. The Haudenosaunee is the name of the tribe, but who was basically kind of their Jesus figure who came and said, he was called the stutterer in English, but the word in Iroquois escapes me. And he had an interpreter whose name was Hiawatha, not the one of the poetry and Longfellow's poem. And you know, he said, okay, guys, it's time to wake up. It's time to live in balance with your world. But that coincided with an environmental apocalypse that was happening to those people at that time, you know, a couple thousand years ago, that might have been associated with a small variation in climate as well that produced drought. I mean, nobody knows exactly how or when, but let me just summarize this and I'll throw it back to you, DiCarlo. I think that we are creating an environmental crisis that is in the process. We are right in the middle of it right now, that is biting us in the butt so hard that we are going to wake up and say, okay, we have screwed the environment. We have devastated the rainforest. We are wiping out the coral all around the world. The fish are dying. All life is dying on this planet because there's 8 going on 9 billion human beings. And it's time for us to figure out how to live sustainably. And that's going to be the great challenge. And that's going to be the great awakening that's going to come probably not in my lifetime, but probably in the lifetime of my children.
Well, because see, that's interesting, and I appreciate that honesty because that is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about just, you know, like you've went through this, the whole ecological history and patriarchal history, but it's just the confession that, you know, primarily it's a myth. I'm sorry, let me just say it that way. Yeah, I'll just say it's a myth. You know, when women of color Native Americans and blacks who stood beside white women in the from the late 1900s to the early to 1920, trying to get the right to vote, and then to be cast aside.
Yep.
Then 50 years later, they're brought up again, and it's like, oh, they're keeping you down.
And look at what's going on right now. You've got going on 20 states now that are passing laws making it harder for people of color to vote.
Exactly.
It's like it hasn't gone away.
Right. And my question is, okay, if they're trying to push this kind of stuff, I'm wondering, where is the support saying, no, you know what, we're not going to go through this again?
Well, I think we are going through it again, and it's things have to hit bottom before they start coming up. You know, the old AA notion. I shouldn't speak of it. I've never been to an AA meeting in my life. But my understanding is that there's this belief that you have to hit bottom before you can come back up. And I don't think we've hit bottom as a society. It horrifies me to think that we will.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But I do. I do think that we will, and I think we're heading in that direction. And our job now is to minimize the damage that's done and prepare for the next generation. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news or call in and inform me. I am just so continually impressed by how smart the people listening to this program are. It is an honor to share this time with you. Marty, in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, you wanted to talk about John Boehner?
Tom, thanks for taking my call, and Happy New Year's to you, Louise, and your whole staff over there. Yeah, I was going to raise a point as to how, he ended up winning, Speaker of the House. But actually, let me throw out a point, too, to touch on your previous caller's points. There's a poison pill that's in the Arctic right now that very few people are really talking about, but I wrote a paper a little while back for my environmental ethics class called Positive Feedback, the Two Scariest Words. And basically, the Arctic right now is sitting on tons of permafrost that locks in methane hydrates.
Right.
So when you...
Wait a minute. There's two things. The methane hydrates are offshore, and the permafrost is onshore. And the permafrost is covering basically giant peat bogs of what used to be vegetation, in some cases 5-10,000 years worth of vegetation, layers 20, 30, 40 feet deep, that's got massive amounts, it's decomposing, massive amounts of methane associated with it that's in there. The methane hydrate crystals are formed by methane basically coming out at the sea bed and freezing. They never made it to the surface. And they're starting to melt and turn like soda pop, bubble out. It's like ice, and it's melting and bubbling out as the ocean is warming, just for sake of clarity here.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. And that the more that permafrost, the more we expose more of that, we start carbon feedback cycles. So
yes,
we have positive feedback cycles where more greenhouse gas is emitted than what's taken out. Those positive cycles will rapidly speed up global warming.
They already have, and this is why this year the ICPP, what is it, the the group of scientists who look at global climate change, IPCC, I think it is, said that the scenarios for climate change that we're looking at right now, the reality that we're experiencing right now, is in the range of what were 10 years ago their worst case to probably never going to happen scenarios. And it is exactly because of those positive feedback loops, because in the oceans we're seeing methane hydrate starting to be released, and there's a lot of it. And on shore we're seeing methane being released from permafrost. And in both cases, the albedo effect is huge, because on land, when the snow melts and the ice melts, the white ice that used to reflect light is replaced by brown peat, which absorbs light aggressively, absorbs heat aggressively. And at sea, when the ice melts, and offshore, on the shorelines, and when that ice melts, it's replaced by blue water, which in the ice reflected light, the blue water absorbs light and then transmits that heat down into lower layers and ultimately warms up those methane hydrate crystals. The real nightmare scenario is when the warming of the ocean, which we didn't think was that big a deal, now we're discovering that most of the heat in the atmosphere is actually being absorbed by the ocean. You know, four-fifths of the planet is covered by water. And I don't know why it didn't ever occur to anybody that that water could heat up. But you know, they're realizing now that most of the heating of the planet is actually happening in the oceans. They're accumulating that heat. And if those warm layers get down to the point where those methane hydrate crystals are in large quantities, and you start seeing a lot of that soda pop melting, you know, fizzing out of the oceans, just, you know, hundreds of billions of tons of methane bubbling out of the oceans, as has happened in the past, we now know from the fossil record, you know, in these 100,000-year cycles, then you're looking at massive climate change in a matter of just a very, very few years because of exactly as you identified, Marty, positive feedback. Thank you for calling and making that point. Very, very well said. Bill in Chippewa Bay, New York. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you tonight?
I'm great. You want to talk about a flat tax?
Yeah, I was just wondering why we don't come up with the idea of taxing all Americans at the same rate.
Because all Americans don't earn at the same rate. Somebody working at McDonald's who's just barely getting by is not using anything close to the resources of the commons, of our government, that we all collectively pay for. They're not using the banking system like a millionaire does. They're not using the roads like a millionaire does. They're not using the court systems. More than half of all the cost of our court systems is for corporate activity. They're not using the court systems the way that the millionaires are. They're not using our fire services. You know, putting out a fire in a $1 million house is a lot harder than putting out a fire in a $10,000-$20,000 house. They're not using the services of we the people the way that people who earn a lot more are, and therefore, they should pay a lot less. Plus, there's two other pieces to this. One, I'm actually in favor of redistributing income so that we have a more egalitarian society, more equal society, because all of the sociological research indicates that more equal societies do better. They have lower crime, they have lower juvenile delinquency, they have lower teenage pregnancies, they have fewer sexually transmitted diseases, they have less mental illness, they have less violence. I mean, go to equalitytrust.org.uk or Google Spirit Level, the Spirit Level by James Wilkerson and Kate Pickett. The research is in, and you can use tax policy as we did during the Republican Eisenhower era to establish a more egalitarian society, a more equal society, number one. And number two, taxes influence behavior. Taxes change behavior. Al Gore is being criticized for selling Current TV just before the first of the year, so he'd pay a lower capital gains rate on that sale than, actually it was probably Joel Hyatt who made the decision, on that sale than if after the first of the year. Well, I understand that perfectly. I did the same thing back in the 80s with a travel business that I owned that I sold in 86 because Reagan dropped the capital gains rate that year, or was going to raise it next year. I forget which it was, but you know, we sold it that year because of that. Over time, those all even out, and they're pretty irrelevant. But by and large, you want to use tax policy to influence behavior, and one of the behaviors that you want to influence is you want to say to people who are earning over $1 million a year, you know, hey, isn't enough enough? Isn't it time to keep some of that money in your business? Isn't it time to use some of that money to pay your workers better?
Oh, I understood. I never actually thought of that idea.
Okay.
From that perspective.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you for the call. Those are all the reasons why I am opposed to the flat tax. I think the flat tax is a bad idea. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, Betty.
Good afternoon, Tom. Happy New Year to you and yours.
Thank you. And you and
Tom,
yours.
Since the, and it's funny you should mention Current, since its inception, Current has been packaged in a manner by the cable companies to make it practically unaffordable, and especially to those who really would want to watch it. All things considered, with the void that we have in the news, how far-reaching do you think the effects will be on the American public resultant of Al Jazeera's buyout of Current TV?
I have no idea. A lot's going to depend on how they program it, and a lot's going to depend on whether they keep it as a premium channel on most networks, on most cable networks. Similarly, MSNBC is a premium channel on most networks. You have to pay extra to get it, and a lot of people don't.
I read a little snippet in the newspaper today. I think it was through an AP article or what, that they expect to get news out as a result of this to as many as 50 million people.
Well, that's how many homes that you can find Current in right now. You know, it's about half of the households in America. There's roughly 100 million households. and about half of them have current available. So, you know, the question is, you know, how are they going to program it? Where is it going to go? What's it going to do? Will it have an impact? I don't have a crystal ball on this stuff. I don't even have a good guess. But thanks, Betty, for calling and asking. It'll be interesting to watch. Tom in Lumberton, Texas. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Happy New Year, Tom. You're doing a great job, and I enjoy listening to
Thank you.
My question is, you've got these Republicans in Congress who are basically trying to change the American way of life, just obstructionists, and obviously they're in the pockets of corporations and rich folks. And my guess is that some of them are getting money funneled to them either through contributing to their campaigns. I mean, they may meet them in a hotel room with a suitcase full of money for all I know. But it seems like it would be fairly easy for the FBI or some agency to at some point start busting a few of these guys here and there for corruption.
Did you see yesterday where Tom DeLay just got sentenced to 3 years in jail?
I didn't. It was a great day yesterday when he got sentenced.
Yeah.
But you don't hear.
And it was in your state.
Much anymore.
It was in Texas.
It wasn't my state.
Yeah.
Awful.
But see, that's the thing. Texas, back in 1907, when Teddy Roosevelt got the Tillman Act passed, which says that it's a felony for anybody to take money from a corporation for political campaigns. When that was passed, and that was knocked down by Citizens United 2 years ago, when that law was passed, a number of states passed similar laws to make it illegal at the state level, and Texas was one of those states. And so Tom DeLay but most states don't have those laws anymore. What Tom DeLay did in Texas, you know, taking campaign contributions from corporations in Texas, is not only not illegal in Wisconsin, but it's standard operating procedure. You know, it's how Michelle Bachmann funds her campaigns. So, but your question about why are these politicians not investigated for bribery? I think the obvious reason is that the people with the money are owning the politicians, and the politicians are writing the rules, and they're writing the rules that protect them and the people with the money. And so what we need to do is break that cycle, and we do that by amending the Constitution to say that money is not speech. Move to amend.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then we could go back and redefine bribery and say, you know, we're going to go after more of these Tom DeLays. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the people at the companies that syndicate our radio program and our television program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and everyone at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. And it means a lot when you let the stations that carry our program, or when you let their advertisers or their underwriters know that you're listening. It means an awful lot. Thank you, particularly to those of you who have gone, you know, taken the effort to do that. Much appreciated. Louise in Eden, North Carolina, you had a question about John Boehner and Hurricane Sandy?
Yes, sir. Long-time watcher and a first-time caller.
Well,
Tom, you're a very smart man, and I admire your knowledge and how you really tell us people here in the U.S. what's going on. Now, the other night I was watching on C-SPAN when they finished up with the vote on the physical cliff. Well, they immediately jumped and banged that gavel, and people that was there, they didn't like it. You could hear the tension in the voice. Now, with that said, Boehner, whatever his name is, has later said that the reason that they didn't take it up was because of the pork in it. Now, with that said, has not the president said that he would veto any bill with pork in it, and if he has said that, can he go ahead and pass a bill, but at the same time say he is vetoing the pork that is in the bill, thus passing the bill but taking the pork out? And right. if he can or cannot, why?
Okay, three great questions. Let me answer them in sort of backwards order. First of all, the president does not have a line item veto, which is what you're describing. He can't veto particular parts of legislation. The closest he can get to that is putting a signing statement into legislation and essentially saying, okay, it's the law, but I'm not going to enforce it. And there, you know, that happens a fair amount of the time, but usually with smaller things, sometimes with larger things, you know, Bush with nuclear weapons, test bans and wars. So he doesn't have that kind of veto power. Number two, the president, to the best of my knowledge, has never said that he was going to veto any legislation that contains pork. And the reason why is because, you know, one man's pork is another man's bacon, or whatever old cliche there is out there. Hurricane Sandy, you could argue it's pork in and of itself, because it's basically going to stimulate a region that was wiped out by hurricanes. And in fact, I would say that one of the indicators to me that our economy is doing as poorly as it is that there are so few jobs that were created when you consider all the jobs that were created by Hurricane Sandy in terms of cleanup and restoration. When you have a disaster, it actually creates jobs, which is the thing that Robert Kennedy pointed out years ago, you know, that we have this bizarre system where, you know, GDP measures Richard Speck's rifle, but it doesn't measure the quality of our families. And then the third point was, why did Boehner do this? Why did he not have the original vote on it? And I honestly don't know the answer to that. I've asked a couple of conservatives who have told me that I've gotten two stories, actually, out of people here in Washington, D.C., who I've, you know, who we've had on the TV show or whatever, here on the radio program. One story is that, it was just a mistake, or there was too much pork in it or whatever. I mean, that's the one that they want everybody to believe. The other story is that Eric Cantor had been given responsibility for shepherding the Sandy legislation through Congress. And even though he's not from that area, he's from Virginia. And although Virginia was affected by Hurricane Sandy. So Eric Cantor was doing it. Cantor voted against the fiscal cliff legislation. That angered Boehner. And so, and Boehner at that point was concerned that Eric Cantor was actually going to launch a challenge to his speakership, which almost happened. I mean, it came within just a couple, with three votes of it. And, in the first round and in the first call. And then they had to go out and grab people and drag them in to vote. So Boehner was basically trying to slap down Cantor. He was trying to hurt Cantor politically by doing this, and it backfired hugely on him when Chris Christie and Peter King went nuts. And so that's everything I know about it, Louise. Does that all make sense?
Oh, yes, yes. Okay. I mean, absolutely. But I just don't understand, Mr. Hartman. And I don't mean no disrespect to anything like that, but it just seems like there are so many black hearts in Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, black hearts, not dark gray, black.
Yeah, well, you know, the old saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you're funded by billionaires who, by and large, are above the law and have the power to just literally flip a democracy, to buy and sell elections, that kind of power is very, very corrupt. You know, it brings in corrupt people, and it corrupts good people. So I think that's what's going on. Louise, thank you for the call. Rick in McKinleyville, California, a little less than a minute here, Rick, before we have to wrap up the show for the week.
I'll be brief then. Long time, second time. I had the kind of a what might some might consider to be a radical idea, but if you consider that the southern area of the United States, a lot of them really haven't forgotten the Civil War, and the southernization of the United States, as has been pointed out by various authors, Chris Hedges and several others, and you recently in your commentary
about Django
Unchained. Yeah. Unchained. I was wondering what you thought of the idea of rather than keeping these two people involved in kind of like a marriage, the North and the South, why don't we give them what they want and let the South succeed?
Let them go. Yeah, Louise has been saying that for a lot of years. I think that the United States of America is the United States of America. We need to work this out. I really do. And we need to recognize the sociopathy down there for what it is. Thank you, Rick, for the call. It actually is a topic deserving of serious conversation, and we'll have to do that next week. Coming up next week, America's fiscal cliff battle may be over, but the war on the debt ceiling is just getting started. Is it time to issue a platinum coin? We're talking about that with Jamie Weinstein, the Daily Caller. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.